Arns versus Tohoto, and I'm sorry, I may be fracturing some names here, so council, please feel free to correct me. This is, again, Arns versus Tohoto, and Mr. Dicu?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the court, members of the court, my name is Mark Dicu. I represent Jason Tohoto and Gina Tohoto. Jason is present here today and is sitting back here with me to hear this argument. It's a matter of great importance to him. Buying a home is part of the American dream, members of the court. At least 63% of people in this country, it'll constitute the largest consumer purchase that they'll ever make. But our homes are more than just consumer purchases. Our homes are sacred places. Our homes are typically where we bring our bride, where we bring our children, where we raise them, and sometimes where we die. We have a lot of events that occur in the typical home, and the Tohoto home is no exception. As a result, our rights to our homes and our right to use our homes are given pretty rigorous protection in the eyes of the law. But what if, 15 years after you bought your home, someone comes forward and says, you know what? I want to be able to use a portion of your property. Why? Because people long, long ago that they don't identify used this property. And they did so at an indefinite period of time. And the trial court, hearing that complaint without a trial, decides on summary judgment, based upon affidavits of an attorney that was then under the shadow of disbarment, that you know what? I'm going to go ahead and give them 6% of your land. We all know that a permanent easement is just that. It's the equivalent of giving them the land. Trial court does that and also tells them, basically, your American dream here is partially broken up. I'm going to give them a portion of what you worked so hard to create and what you worked so hard to maintain. And in addition, to add insult to this injury, I'm going to put on you, the homeowner, the obligation to maintain that property for the public to be able to make that driveway bigger so that other people, unidentified members of the public who have no interest in using that driveway, can use it. Not going to compensate you for it. You still have to pay for the taxes, the insurance, if it's even available, the utilities, any maintenance that you may incur on that property. Suddenly, your American dream is shattered. I ask you, who would buy a piece of property like this that's subject to an easement for the public? If you are able to even sell this property, I submit to you that it's going to result in a huge premium. You're going to have to take a discount on the purchase of that price to be able to sell that property. Members of the court, this case is absolutely abhorrent to me. When I saw this, I thought, you know, I've got to research this. And in none of the cases that I've looked at have I seen this issue, a public prescriptive easement, decided on summary judgment. Just doesn't happen. So members of the court.
So what, in your opinion, what was the material fact that should have prevented a summary judgment?
The claim of right, in my opinion. The claim of right and also the presumption of permissiveness that occurred. So there are at least three issues of first impression here, but there are at least five issues where there are genuine issues of material fact. The claim of right has to be the greatest one. There was no assertion by anyone of a right to use that property. And in fact, if the court looks at it, it's a matter of first impression. Everyone in this case thought that this was an Otoe County road. All of the affidavits say this is an Otoe County road. In all of the cases I have examined, not a single one involved people using the property of someone else thinking that it was a public road. Everyone says, you know what, I knew it was their property, but I used it anyways. In fact, the rule is it is visible and exclusive possession with the intent to possess the land under the belief that it belongs to them. That's part of a public prescriptive easement in the case. Everyone, I might add, is presumed to know the law. If you're presumed to know the law, then there's no way you can adversely possess public property. And in fact, I think the appellees even concede that in this case. This case, you can't adversely possess or get a prescriptive easement on public property. So if you can't possess property in that manner, how can you even begin to possess it up to the boundaries of a so-called easement area? Certainly, there was no evidence of a written notice that was ever delivered to any owner of the property in this case. There's simply no evidence of that. And depending on the age of this, and you have to remember, the trial court went back quite a ways in their analysis saying, at some indefinite time in the past, long before the parties involved in this case ever bought their interests, this happened. I mean, I'm stunned by that. But when you look at the record, you'll see there was an affidavit of marketable title that was filed in 1958 that cut off everything that occurred before. And that would be uses such as a post office and a public store. I think they referred to it as the general store in the facts of this case. But in addition, there was no claim after that period of time that was ever filed. And that brings us to another issue of first impression in this case. What is the operation of the Nebraska Marketable Title Act with respect to this property? Yes, I've seen the cases that talk about, well, if you don't protect your property, boom, you lose. It's a statute of limitations. If you don't do anything for 10 years, you've lost your rights with respect to that property. But not a single one of those cases ever addressed the effect of the Nebraska Marketable Title Act. So what does that act require? That act requires, number one, that someone have a road of title of at least a chain of title of at least 22 years, plus a road of title. In this case, that goes back to 1972. That's when the Rosses first acquired their interest. I mean, one of the Rosses owned it all the way back to 1957 when they filed that affidavit. But 1972 is our writ of title. No one filed any claim within that period of time from 1972 going forward. So that brings us to 1995. What happens in 93? This Haveman, one of the affiants, loses his grain dealer's license. Nobody's going to this easement area anymore. And nobody goes to it until 1998. But again, that's on the outside envelope of what the trial court found in this particular case.
So is your argument that the Nebraska Marketable Title Act trumps the law on either adverse possession or prescriptive easements?
I believe it does.
And what authority do you have for that?
That's the problem. The issue has never been brought up in any of these cases, Your Honor. Now, the appellees cite the court to two cases, one, I believe, a Minnesota case, and the other to an Iowa case. But in each of those two cases, we were dealing with a statutory exception to the Marketable Title Act. In other words, in Minnesota, for example, it went back 40 years. You go back, your look back is 40 years, and then there's an exception saying, except for persons in possession of the property. That Minnesota case, it was reversed and sent back for a trial on the issue of whether the public had notice that that individual was using that property. The Iowa statute is the same. The Iowa statute contains an exception. That's to people who can prove visible use. But it's funny, because the Nebraska case doesn't have an exception like that. The legislature did not carve out a specific exception for adverse possession or prescription. In this particular case, I think that act applies to extinguish any ancient interest like this. Anything that arose prior to 1952, anything that arose prior to 1995.
Wouldn't that have been something for the legislature to do as opposed to us making that decree?
Well, it's a simple analysis because it's either there or it's not. We have that Marketable Title Act and it imposes certain requirements on people, and that is that you file a written notice of claim. They had 23 years to do that. No member of the public did anything in this particular
case. But in all the adverse possession cases, at least that I've been involved with since 2011 or before, oftentimes there was never any claim of right or, you know, it's always circumstantial evidence. It's not so much direct evidence.
Well, the evidence that I've seen in the cases, and I have seen the cases that you've written, by the way, Your Honor, I know that you write a good deal of those cases. But in almost every single one of those cases, there's direct evidence that people use that property. But nobody argued the application of the Marketable Title Act. We did that here. There has to be some ability to be able to quiet title in people. This simply cannot go on forever. And in this particular case, we have people, innocent landowners, that are being subjected to a servitude, if you will, that happened years before they ever bought their property. But that brings me also to the claim of right, and I wanted to address that quickly to the court. The claim of right is something that absolutely boggles my mind in this particular case. As I mentioned, everyone thought this was an Otoe County case, or thought this was an Otoe County property, but the reality was it was always public property. Nobody ever asserted a claim to it. And what's even more interesting, and the evidence was unequivocal in this respect, and I think it also created a genuine issue of fact. That evidence was that the homeowners got along with everyone. They didn't tell people, get your stuff off my property. That suggests to me, and it creates an inference in our favor, it creates a genuine issue of material fact. Was this neighborliness on their part? I believe it was. It doesn't look like they were acquiescing in it. And in fact, there's no evidence other than the county doing some sporadic maintenance that anyone did any type of maintenance that would create some type of interest or would create a perception that that individual was exercising some sort of domain over that property. Lastly, I wanted to address and very quickly the issue of mootness. The appellees in this case have another access to this property. They have a route to this property. I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. May I sum up briefly?
Yes.
The appellees in this case signed a second easement. That easement is on a neighboring property. It gives them complete access to the property they sought access to across my client's property. We have dueling roads now. That other easement lasts as long as their easement lasts, which ours does not. Ours lasts in perpetuity. That other easement, they can do whatever they want to with it any time of the day they want to. Your Honors, I thank you for your time. At this point, I would ask just briefly that you consider the shattered American dream that my clients are suffering from at this point. I ask that you dismiss the appellee's complaint. I ask that you quiet the title in the Dakotas. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Dickey. How much did we go over? How much time did we go over? Okay, please add that to the appellee's time. And you may approach Mr. Prickett.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Tom Prickett, and I represent the appellees Don and Ken Ahrens. I want to briefly address one point in rebuttal before I forget, and that's the issue of mootness. The secondary road was created out of an emergency situation. My clients had equipment stored on their improved property at the end of this road that they needed access to, and they also had grain stored there in a falling grain market, and they needed access to their equipment and their grain. And so they had to create this emergency road and do what they had to do because their access had been cut off. But a brief roadmap of what I'd like to discuss here today, first of all, is what I think is the most salient issue in this case is these dueling presumptions, the presumption of permissiveness versus the presumption of adverseness, and which is appropriate in this case. Then I want to briefly talk about what a hostility or a claim of right means in the context of a public prescriptive easement. And then I will address the Marketable Title Act and why that's not dispositive of this case. And finally, I'd like to remind the court of the practical implications of the decision before them today. The issue of which presumption applies is a very fact-intensive inquiry. I think it requires a careful reading of numerous cases. But the general rule in Nebraska is that when there's been an open and notorious use for at least 10 years, then adverseness and a claim of right is presumed. There are a few narrow exceptions to that general rule, and they basically come from two cases. The first case is Scoville v. Fisher. It's an older case. That case involved uninhabited, wild, unenclosed lands. And I think the rationale for that exception was if you have uninhabited vacant land that you don't go to very often, you might not be apprised. And I think of, you know, a woods or very wild land that you don't go to very often, you might not be apprised of who's going on that land. That's inapplicable to the situation, the facts in this case. We have a residence, we have a grain business, we have a polling site. This is very used inhabited land that we're dealing with here. And ultimately, the second case that involves the exceptions is Felony v. Bay. And in passing, they note that the Scoville case was improperly decided. But Felony v. Bay created another factual narrow exception that basically stands for the proposition that when a landowner opens up a roadway for his own purposes and the claimant's use is in common with that purpose, then it's deemed to be permissive and not adverse. That's just simply not in line with the facts and the evidence in this case. The evidence in this case is that this roadway was originally created to be a thoroughfare through the town of Wyoming to get to the general store, the post office, and the grain elevator. So in other words, the creation was by the use that the Aarons are using actually predated what is now the owner's use. That residence that the Dakotas live in now and inhabit wasn't constructed until 1929, years after Main Street, Wyoming is being used for these other purposes. So I think that the underpinning of that narrow exception just doesn't apply here because the landowner didn't open up that road for a particular use. The use actually predated the current use.
Well, and the Felony versus Bay was a shared driveway in the city of Omaha.
Yes, and I do believe that it's factually distinguishable as well, Your Honor. If you look at Felony v. Bay, it's a somewhat recent use. It's, you know, the 2000s forward, and it's residential. It's in Omaha, a residential neighborhood involving alleys. And if you look at this other line of cases, there's a lot of them. There's at least six that I'm aware of in that properly apply the adverse presumption, deals with rural settings and usually farmers, ranchers, moving livestock, moving equipment, gaining access to remote areas. But I think the key here also is how long the use has persisted. One of the quotes in a case that I think is absolutely factually on point and legally on point is Lou v. Little. And they state in that case, when a person proves uninterrupted and open use for the necessary period without evidence to explain how the use began, the presumption is raised that it's adverse and under a claim of right. Before they set that proposition out, they note that the litigants in that case were in their 80s, and the use of Trail Road, as it was in that case, predated the memories of the litigants. And I think that's key. When you have a situation where a use is so long, so ingrained for generations, for decades, that someone can't adduce evidence as to where that use originated, the presumption needs to be adverseness. And that's what the whole line of cases that exist and cited in my brief do. That's the factual setting.
And what facts in this case supported your argument in that regard?
So there were multiple affidavits by people who had lived, farmers essentially, who had lived in that area the entire life. Some of them were in their 70s, some of them were in their 80s, and they all averred in their affidavits that essentially they've been using Deer Road their entire life, from the point of the time when they hauled grain by horse and buggy. They used that road, and they used that road to haul grain to Haverman Grain Company from the 70s through 1998, when it was sold to my clients. And so it was just
did all that use end though at the time your client bought the property?
I'm sorry, sir.
Other than by your client, did that use end at the time that your client bought the property?
Well, I think it did. I think there's evidence that Larry Starner, the neighbor, continued to use it to reach his improvements. I think there's evidence that the county still maintained it, that the U.S. Post Office used it, that maybe the trash service used it to access the Dakota's driveway. So I think that's the key is that a use that's so long in existence, when you can't adduce evidence as to how it started, it's necessary for that adverse presumption to apply.
Was there any conflicting evidence offered in opposition to that?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason for that, and it's just like the Lou v. Little case, and it's just like the case of Moon Lake Ranch LLC v. Gamble, which wasn't cited in my brief, but is factually analogous and legally analogous. And that's an unreported case from this court in 2017. Granted summary judgment on a prescriptive easement. And just like in Lou v. Little, just like in Moon Ranch, in this case, the prescriptive easement had arisen before the Dakotas owned their property, before the people who were now objecting to that longstanding use purchased the property. And this is an open and obvious use. There are improvements at the end of that road that the only way to get to is through Deer Road. And I think even if you don't apply a presumption in this case, if you just look at the evidence, that adverseness and a claim of right is established, because all these people averred that they used that road because they thought they could, they thought it was a public road, and that they never asked and they never sought permission. They used it because they thought they had the right to. And when you look at what is hostility or adverseness, a claim of right in a public prescriptive easement case, it's not that you own fee title, it's that you have an indefeasible right to travel on that road. I drove here on Interstate 80 today. I don't think I own Interstate 80. I don't think I can develop that for my own land, but I think that I have a right to use it and no private individual can stop me from doing so. That's the public prescriptive easement part of it.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that there were several questions of material fact?
Well, I don't think there were any issues of material fact because I don't, first of all, as I read the appellant's brief, there were none that were pointed out. And today, what I heard was adverseness and a claim of right. And I think those are legal issues. But ultimately, I think the Dakotas were too late in time to rebut anything. They didn't get there until 2003 when they purchased the property. They don't have firsthand knowledge and they didn't adduce any evidence that could rebut all these farmers and local community members who provided evidence of how this land had been used for a century. So they just didn't have the personal knowledge to provide any rebuttal evidence.
And then how do you respond to his argument about the Marketable Title Act?
Thank you, Your Honor. The Marketable Title Act is created to essentially extinguish ancient title defects to which there is no longer any social utility to. And so I haven't found a single Nebraska case that had where the Marketable Title Act was used to extinguish an adverse possession claim. And beyond that, I think it fails for two other reasons. First of all, under our Marketable Title Act, to invoke it, you have to be in possession of the real estate. That's a requirement under Nebraska Revised Statute 78-288. And in this case, if you think about a prescriptive easement, possession is use. And in this case, there's unrefuted evidence that the public has been using this road for a century. And so I would argue that the Dakotas are not in exclusive possession of Deer Road because it's been adversely possessed, it's been used by the public for this entire time. So they don't have the element to make that claim originally. And then secondly, I think the spirit and intent of the Marketable Title Act is to protect against ancient defects, the over-meticulous title examiner, that was what it was meant to do. And this is an ongoing, reoccurring use that keeps going. So if you think about it, even if the Marketable Title Act, for purposes of argument, extinguished the prescriptive easement for a period of time, this is an ongoing use and it reestablishes itself every 10 years. So if it was ever extinguished, it was recreated by the fact that it's been continually used for the past century. Finally, I just want to briefly, if you'll indulge me, discuss the practical implications of this case.
Your time's up.
Okay, thank you. Thank
you,
Your Honor.
You got the extra time. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
No rebuttal. He went over.
All right. I believe that will end the arguments on this case. And thank you very much, counsel. You are excused, and we will take the case under submission.